Welcome to the Biota.org Interviews Podcast. This is part of the special series taken from the audio of the Biota 2 conference. Today's speaker is Stephen Rook.
Right, so this is this is a traditional genetic cross-dissolve in the sense defined by Carl Sims in his 1991 SIGGRAPH paper. I read that paper and immediately had to quit my job as a programmer at the observatory and start writing this stuff. So what you do is you evolve images, and we don't have time to describe how the whole process of how you do that, but the lineage derives from Richard Dawkins, the blind watchmaker, Carl Sims, 1991. These are all texture images. There's no explicit geometry at all. Each still image is a single evolved organism where the same program, the same organism as a program, runs on every pixel in the whole image. What you're seeing here are genetic cross-dissolves. So I put one keyframe at one end and one at the other end of this sequence you're looking at, and everything that's happening in between is traversing genetic relatives. So suppose I had a remote common ancestor with a living Kung tribesman in South Africa 100,000 years ago. Today we would have countless relatives all alive today spread around the continents. And you could imagine picking a trajectory from face to face and body to body through all our living relatives until you connected them all up. That's what this genetic cross-dissolve does. Unlike normal keyframing, where you can, which is sort of a morph, you can predict what's going to happen going from one frame to the next. In the genetic cross-dissolve, all sorts of unexpected things happen in between. I don't know that there's any biological analog of this sort of genetic traversal in nature, unless it's down in the bacterial world, which we'll see in a bit. Now remember, there's no geometry, there's no three-dimensionality to this stuff at all. I found that to get to the point I have here, beyond what Carl did in 1991, the biggest thing is simply having built up a large genetic library, a large database of genomes. And that took a couple of several years of my time to do, and a whole lot of DAT tapes in my shelves. And the other thing that I do that's a bit different from Carl is I have a much higher ratio of sexual crossover. I find that you get further faster with about a 60% sexual crossover, maybe 10% mutation, 10 or 20% fit clones from the previous generation, and an occasional reintroduction of seed organisms that you started with at the beginning of the simulation. It's not a simulation. So these are genetic fractals where I added a new type of virtual DNA from what I had last year, which codes for the internals of it basically can generate any fractal function, anything to the right-hand side of that of the equal sign in the iteration loop. And that's all nested down inside the outer genome, which is similar to the one Carl described in 1991. But I think I'll stop the video now, and if someone could turn the slide projector on. So this is a still image. This would be just, say, one evolved image. again, the same program. It's one evolved organism. Same program operates on every pixel. So it's a texture image, no geometry. This is going back, it's a total of four generations. And in this scheme, I use green. A green border represents that you got there by having two parents, normal sex. Red is mutation. Yellow is just a clone from the previous generation, and that's all we have there. This goes back, I believe, seven generations. Red is parthenogenesis, or sex with itself. It's not very sharply defined. And if you go back, 13 generations total, with a breeding population of only 100 organisms, it's inevitable that you get a lot of interbreeding. And there turned out to be lots of closets in the, lots of skeletons in the closets back in the number of generations. You really don't want to talk about a whole lot. But that's not what I'm here to talk about today. What I'd like to do is talk about symbiogenesis, and is that something that we could apply or should apply to artificial life? And that really comes down to what you think of as an individual, as a programmer, when you're sitting down to design a system. So basically, this is going to be my Lynn Margulis pitch. And I decided to do this. I've never met Lynn Margulis or Dorian Sagan, her son. I decided to do this because I felt that the ALOT community has really is not very aware of Margulis's opinions, of her work and of her opinions. So I thought I would take on the role today of trying to pitch Margulis's point of view as though I fully believe it. And I'm not a biologist, so I'm not really qualified to judge a lot of this, but just pretend that I know a little bit about what I'm talking about, and we'll see if we can make sense of it at the end. And the other thing is, probably one of the reasons Lynn Margulis is not, and her ideas are not well represented in ALOT conferences is because I believe she detests computers. And so you tend not to find many of her students here. But I believe it might be a powerful, there might be some very useful things in here. So, and excuse me if I mispronounce biological terms. I'm sure I'll butcher them as I go through, so feel free to yell out the proper pronunciation. The other thing about this is that as programmers, we really don't have time to read all the proper literature. You don't have time to go out and get a doctorate in biology, biological evolution, ethology, or whatever. If you're a working programmer, all you have time to do is read the non-technical literature, which in practice means you read everything that Richard Dawkins wrote, and then you just start writing programs like crazy. So what I'd like to do here is just give a sort of summary of at least my perception of some of the competing claims made by Lynn Margulis. So why symbiogenesis? I'll make the following assertions. Number one, Lynn Margulis' proven as well as speculative claims of symbiogenesis are relevant to ALIVE system design. And two, lack of attention to the question, what is an individual, can place a programmatic straitjacket on the emergence of symbioses in ALIVE systems. And third, the concept of the individual is critical when assigning fitness and in the emergence of rich nested hierarchical systems. As Margulis says, the Cambrian explosion had a long microbial fuse. Oh, can someone lend me their umbrella for a pointer? Please. Thank you. This is great. I've never owned an umbrella before. I live in the desert, and so. Parasol. Yes, thank you. Okay. So here we have the origin of the Earth at 4.6 billion years ago. I guess on this island, maybe I should say 4,600 million years ago. I'm not quite sure about the billion, million thing over here. Anyway, the origin of life appears to be around, or at least no later than 3.9 billion years ago, prokaryotes, bacteria without nuclei or without membrane around their DNA. The eukaryotes, the nucleated organisms, arose at around 2 billion years, somewhere between 2 and 1.5 billion years. And then you had a long period of time until the Cambrian explosion at about 543 million years ago. And this is where all the action is, according to most of what we hear here. Now, the first type of genetic exchange, the first type of sex, was transgenic. I believe this has already been brought up, so I won't spend a lot of time on it. Bacterial sex is pretty loose, even by contemporary American standards. And those are three bacteria. And I believe it's been mentioned, I'll just say it again, that there's a good case that in bacteria there are no species. There are certainly different species names given to bacteria, but that may be much more a function of their different types of metabolism, what they use for energy, nutrients, and the temperature and gaseous environment in which they live. But bacteria of quite different species can and frequently do exchange genetic material. You can see this happening in the microscope. Okay, this is my microbial mat slide. On the bottom here is a section from Lynn Margulis and Dorian Sagan's Microcosmos Coloring Book, showing just the upper couple of millimeters of a microbial mat. And microbial mats are mostly composed of bacteria. There are a few protists in some of them. And when I say protists, let's say bacteria, prokaryota, kingdom Monera, whatever. The next thing up would be what Lynn Margulis calls protoctists, commonly referred to as protists, that are mostly single-celled creatures which constitute everything else that's not an animal, plant, or fungus. Okay, so this is mostly bacteria, and the upper layers are photosynthetic. The green and blue-green bacteria here are normal photosynthesizers. The purple are thiocapsa. They're hydrogen sulfide metabolizing organisms. They excrete sulfur the way blue-green algae excrete oxygen. And on the upper left is a photo. I don't know if you can see it very well with the lights here, but that's just a photo of Hamelin Bay or Hamelin Pool at Shark Bay, Australia. So these are living stromatolites. This is a 2-billion-year-old fossil, banded iron formation, representing the stromatolites or microbial mats that were prevalent from about 2.2 to 1.8 billion years ago, when they basically dropped all the iron, dissolved iron, out of the floor of the oceans. This is a section from a South African stromatolite fossil compared to a cut piece of a microbial mat, of a living microbial mat from Cuba, just showing how there really are appear to be the same thing after 2 billion years of evolution. Now, the eukaryotic cell. I won't go into the whole story about symbiogenesis and how it was finally determined that, in fact, mitochondria did have a separate genetic origin and chloroplasts or plastids. I believe that's pretty much accepted by everyone now. The eukaryotic transition, according to Lynn Margulis, occurred in stages, in three stages of different fusions, different mergers. And from her point of view, the first merger was that of spirochete bacteria, which ended up becoming the undulopodia of the eukaryotic cell. And there are some indications that there is separate centriole kinetosome DNA that is now being found in some protists. And this has been her Margulis's sort of long-sought goal. She's been pushing this theory for ever since the early 70s. And it does appear that evidence is now coming in support of it, although it's still highly controversial. But it's accepted that the mitochondria were sort of the next symbiotic merger, or many might say the first symbiotic merger, around 2 billion years ago. And after that, at some point after that in time, blue-green algae merged with these guys to form plant, or the ancestors of plant cells. And the nucleus probably came from a bacterium, something like thermoplasma. Okay, so this is a diagram of how it might have happened, and I'm just going to focus here on the controversial part that Margulis has been pushing, that the undulopodia, the wiggly parts coming out of protists and also out of eukaryotic cells, out of our own eukaryotic cells, originated as free-swimming spirochete bacteria. And this is just a diagram to show how that might have happened. There are sort of two main ways that people seem to think symbiosis occurred. One is by the bacteria might have started out as a parasite, parasitizing this other organism, and or this organism might have eaten one of these. The thing about spirochetes is they swim they're rapid swimmers, and we'll see later on in a slide that living free-swimming spirochete bacteria do often, in fact, attach themselves to the backs of protists and propel them around. Yes?
One of the prokaryotes being invaded by something alien, and said to the other one, I don't want this eukaryote.
Touche. Very good, Bruce. Well, let's see. I was going to skip over this slide because the point of putting this in here. Well, I won't skip over it right now. This is an undulopodium. This is a cross section of the little wiggly things that stick off the outsides of our cells. In fact, the sperm cells, as Lynn says, from men to ginkgo trees, the cilia in our lungs, in our oviducts and everything, in her view, all originated as free-swimming bacteria. The reason I was going to skip over this slide instead of mentioning it is Lynn has mentioned a very speculative and clearly much more controversial extension of the notion of spirochete symbiosis, which is that the tubulin structure in these microtubules and the nature of the proteins, the character of the proteins in the rods, in the sensory cells, in our own rod cells, in our retina, and in the olfactory bulb, and in fact, the microtubules in our neurons, down the axons and dendrites, themselves may have originated as free-swimming spirochete bacteria. And the sort of fanciful way to think of this is, here are all your neurons stuck in your brain. Spirochete started out as these fast-swimming things with little rotary hydrogen ion pumps inside them. They can't move around anymore, but they still want to move. So they're propelling ions along the neurons. And if you look at it that way, then in fact, what we're doing right now, thinking, could be thought of as a representative of the most ancient bacterial merger. He's actively trying to move spirochete bacteria. Okay, this is just a coffee table book type diagram showing the various mergers. So back in the Archean, the only type of sex was transgenic, bacterial sex. The first merger took place, according to Lynn Margulis, when spirochete bacteria merged with fermenting bacteria to form anaerobic protists. And that's the first cell symbiogenesis, which she calls hypersex, which makes sense, we'll see if we think about it a little bit. The next merger, and probably the first one that most biologists would confidently agree with, was that of the ancestors of mitochondria with these anaerobic protists to form the first aerobic protists. And at the same time, meiotic sex arrived. And if Margulis is right about the spirochete origin of undulopodia, then she's also right, presumably, or at least makes the case, that mitosis itself, the things that allows our cells to divide normally, also originated from the spirochete merger. So then you have the next merger. The third main merger was that of cyanobacteria, blue-green bacteria, photosynthesizers with these guys. And so you had algae, which have both mitochondria and chloroplasts, finally leading on to plants. Okay, just to put all that in perspective, I'm going to skip over this slide in terms of time. And all right, so now let's go up to the next level, above the individual cells. In the slime mold, in cellular slime molds, you have a stage of independent amoebae, invisible single-celled amoebae crawling around the forest floor, which as the fall progresses, conditions get cooler, merge to form a slug, a nice little piece of slime, which you can see crawling around logs, and it exhibits behavior. I mean, if there's food, the slime will head towards the food, and it is some sort of directed behavior. And then as conditions further dry out, the thing sends up a cyst-bearing stalk from which spores are released, go out. The spores then winter through as just individual spores, and in the spring form amoebae again. Let's move on here. Okay, well, I had to put in some Ernst Haeckel, and please pronounce me on Haeckel's last, correct my pronunciation on Haeckel's last name. Is that correct? Ernst Haeckel, okay. Have to put some of Haeckel's slides in here as eye candy because he had this wonderful vision of what was going on. In the slime mold, there's just a single genome. there are all these different different stages in the life cycles, as you can see in the previous slide, but there's only one genome. However, a slime mold does focus your attention on what is the individual. Because obviously you could look at it at different stages of the life cycle, and the amoeba is an individual one stage, and then the spore stalk is, the slug is, and so on. Lichens might be the next thing up in scale, and with a lichen is a symbiosis between a fungus and either an algae or bacteria. If you cultivate the fungus separately in a petri dish, you just get a patch of fungus in your petri dish, basically. Same with the phycobiont, with the algae or whatever it is. And only when they get together, when they form a structure, a highly interpenetrated structure, the fungal hyphae are tightly interwoven with the strands of algae, but they produce these structures. And the structure of the lichen, it derives from two genomes, but it's pretty obvious that the formation of the structure depends upon the genes in both of the separate genomes cooperating that have just evolved or co-evolved together to produce this large organism. But again, what is the individual? Is the lichen an individual, or are the things with their separate genomes the individual? Another thing about lichens is that there are some 25,000 different fungal symbionts, and it's thought that that lichen symbiosis probably arose thousands of different times on the Earth. Lichens were probably the first colonizers of the land, preparing the way for soil and later plants. Okay, this is a diagram of a comparison between symbiosis and sex. If you think about what happens with lichens, there's a stage when the lichens go to reproduce, they send off spores, which are just the fungal genome, and algae, whatever they do. And the spores disperse, the algal, whatever they are, disperse as well. And at some point later on, there's recognition, merging, integration, and you have the adult lichen. And the process is repeated. Sex can be diagrammed in the same way. You have sperm and egg going their separate ways in their adult vehicles, in the bodies of the creatures that are created by So here you have the adult bodies carrying the sperm. Here's a man, here's a woman or male or female snail. And at some point, again, there's recognition between the two adult organisms, mating, fertilization, and so on, and you finally end up with another organism. So Dr. Margolis makes the case that sex itself probably arose through a symbiotic process, or at least there's very similar processes, and symbiogenesis clearly had to come first. I like carrying this umbrella. I'm a bad habit. I'll skip past the tube worms. I'll just go briefly past the tube worms. These are tube worms at hydrothermal sea vents. These guys only have the adults do not have a mouth. Their larvae have a mouth, and during the larval stage, they ingest the bacteria, a couple of different types of symbiotic bacteria, and then when they molt, going from the larval stage to the tube stage, the adult no longer has a mouth. The water comes in through its diffuses through the walls, cell walls, or is taken in by some other means. But there is no mouth, gut, or anus. The entire metabolism takes place in specialized organelles or organs inside the tube worms, inside of which the bacteria do all the work. So again, what is the individual? Is it the tube worm or the bacteria or some combination thereof? Skip past moss animals, bryozoa, in the interest of time, and go straight to termites. Termites are great. They really focus your attention on the question of what is an individual. I lifted this slide from Dr. Dawkins's Climbing Mount Improbable. These are Australian compass termite mounds oriented north-south. And there's a great passage in the extended phenotype talking about, the way I interpret it, what is the individual? I mean, is the termite mound an extension of the termite? Well, in some sense, it clearly is. And we'll go past the individual termite. Well, when you look at termites at the individual termite level, of course, you think social insect colonies, and most people would claim that the individual is the colony. It's not an individual termite any more than the cells, the skin cells that we sloughed off in the shower this morning are individuals. But it gets even weirder when you look down inside a termite. In the hindgut of the termite, you have all kinds of strange things going on. A termite cannot digest wood on its own. So to the right of this blue sort of line here, this is the wall of the termite's gut. This is an individual termite cell over here. This is another individual termite cell. The red, colored red here, are the mitochondria. And everything to the left of this blue line that's inside the hindgut of the termite, and there are literally thousands of different bacteria and protists, all of which are necessary, or some combination of which are necessary for the termite to be able to digest wood. This purple thing over here is a protist called Oxymonas. We'll see in the next slide. Backward. So here's Oxymonas, and this thing is attached to the termite wall, to the side of the termite. And when you look at these things, it appears that the termite genome has evolved sort of docking structures for these protists, which live symbiotically in its gut. Here are little wood chips represented inside the Oxymonas symbiote, this protist. And here we have Trichonympha, one of the everyone's favorite protists, studies termites, also digesting wood. And Trichonympha has both its own undulopodia, the wiggly thing sticking off of it, and attached freely swimming spirochete bacteria, which give it motility. And again, there are numerous organisms inside the termite. So again, what is the individual? And when I say what is the individual, I would like you to think about that in the sense of being an artifice-like programmer. Let's just focus on that. So let's take a look at one of the termite symbionts. This is Mixotricha paradoxa. And in this particular organism, you can really see the interaction or interrelation between the termite genome. Everything to the right here or below is inside the termite. Inside the termite. Inside Mixotricha paradoxa, inside the protist. These little rod-shaped things are bacteria, and these wiggly guys are the spirochete bacteria which propel Mixotricha around. These appear to be docking structures. It's as though the Mixotricha genome, the protist genome, has evolved structures specifically for these different types of bacteria, and as the protist develops, it just acquires these bacteria. They just accumulate, congregate, and start pushing the thing around, which enables the protist to find food and get food for metabolism. Oh, and the other thing is about Mixotricha is, of course, it has its own undulopodia, which Lynn Margulis claims are derived from this same type of symbiosis, which would have occurred much earlier in geological time. Okay, here's a light micrograph of Trichonympha, and on the right is a diagram of another protist called Stephanonympha, in which there are four undulopodia attached to each nucleus. This is a single protist, single-cell creature, but it has a lot of different nuclei. Each nucleus has four of these undulopodia sticking off of it. And I colored blue-green the freely swimming attached spirochetes on the back of the thing. So again, what is the individual? And the more that you look at these things, the less strange Margulis' speculation about the possible spirochete origin of neurons becomes. I mean, these things are really odd. Well, Giardia, monsters from inner space. I don't think I'll spend too much time on those. You probably can't see this slide very well, but I'm sure everyone knows about the leafcutter ants, tropical leafcutter ants, who cannot eat the leaves, but bring the leaves down into their colonies to feed and cultivate and farm fungus. And the fungus has evolved. Fungus has evolved specialized nipples, which provide nectar to the ants. So, if you go, I left out Julian Huxley's definition of what is an individual. Let me just introduce that. Julian Huxley, 1912, trying to define what an individual is in the animal kingdom. Certain bits of organic machinery are of such a nature that it is physically impossible for the animal to live at all if they are seriously tampered with. It is just because our blood circulation is so swift and efficient and our nervous system so splendidly centralized that damage to heart or brain means almost instant death to us, while a brainless frog will live for long and a heartless part of a worm will not only live but regenerate. Well, you can think about that in the context of this ant-fungus symbiosis. If you remove the ant from the fungus, the ant will die, and the ant cannot function without the fungus, and likewise, from what I understand, the same is true of the fungus. So, by that definition, the individual is the combined ant-fungus colony. Right, this is Arthur Koestler's notion of a holarchy, a nested hierarchy of repeated subunits at smaller levels. And when you're talking about holarchies, you also talk about the Roman god Janus, where at each level in the hierarchy, when you're looking down to lower levels, you're looking at included subordinate levels are self-contained wholes, whereas if you're looking in the opposite direction upward, you are a subordinate part of something else. And let's see. I was going to go on about evolution of data structures through geological time. I'll just mention it quickly here. You can, when you think about this and look at the different data structures you see as a programmer, I look at them as data structures. DNA is a linear GA. The gene cascade of enzymes marching along the DNA, building up proteins, is a tree structure, a branching tree structure. And then inside the cell, the genomic regulatory network is a network, and that's what could be a directed graph. I'm going to move along here. Okay, so I'm going to spend a bit of time on this. Professor Dawkins makes the point that the only causal arrows that exist in the system, in natural selection, are those going from replicators, genes, upward, or in this direction, upward to vehicles, bodies, and also from bodies out to the extended phenotype, the environment. Lynn Margulis points out that that's not enough because, all right, that may be true and is true in a single generation, but these guys couldn't be here. The replicators and vehicles wouldn't be here were it not for 3.9 billion years of modification of the environment, of gas exchange. The entire environment today is totally different from what it was at the beginning of life. So I attempted to make a different diagram, a three-dimensional diagram here. If you make time the vertical axis, in a single generation, the causal arrows go from genes to bodies to extended phenotype. There is no causal arrow that can possibly come back that anyone's been able to think of. Any possible way to do that, to get any causal arrow back to make a Lamarckian form of inheritance. But there is another type of memory besides heredity, and that is simple persistence by physics in the environment. So on this side, the memory is heredity, is genetics, DNA. On that side is physics, it's persistence. And it seems to me in that case, there is, in some sense, a backward causal arrow, but it's a very indirect one. Yeah?
You might compare what's going on the right-hand side to what a Turing machine does, where you make marks in your environment that become part of your extended state.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right, let me move on here. All right, I want to mention Lynn Margulis spends quite a bit of time talking about autopoiesis. And she believes that autopoiesis is more important than a focus on strict genetic evolution. From Greek roots, the word means self-making. Autopoiesis places an emphasis on metabolism. Autopoietic entities are efficient dissipators of heat. They win consistently in the Olympics for the second law of thermodynamics. They continually construct and adjust the dynamic physical structures by which they are bounded. The smallest, minimal autopoietic system is the smallest bacterial cell. Larger autopoietic systems are organisms, cohesive groups of organisms. Those autopoietic entities which are capable of reproduction are subject to natural selection. But Lynn Margulis includes as an autopoietic entity, and therefore as a living entity, Gaia, which is not capable of reproduction, or not yet. And I would add that current alive systems are probably also autopoietic systems if you include the environment, the software, the hardware, infrastructure, human maintainers, and so on. So is it genes, bodies, or environment? I think I made that point already. Replicators, genes need vehicles, bodies. Bodies need nutrients and environment. Since the beginning of life, the environment has been actively modified by living organisms. This figure is a diagram from the A-Life 3 proceedings. This is from Niels Boss, who made the point that the underlying interaction graph in this figure is much more subtle than merely a tree, as for ordinary hierarchies, or just general graphs or networks. We think that this is a very general, useful, and important process which may be applied to a variety of new structures, systems, in order to obtain new, fundamentally new, structures with new emergent properties. Can you take that umbrella, please? Thank you. Okay, some of us are familiar with Carl Sims' architecture for his creatures, evolved creatures with evolved behavior, in 1994. And the point I'd like to make about this is that this is more than a neural net. And I was talking with Larry Yeager about this a little bit earlier, but more goes on inside the nodes of these things than simple models of just accumulating weights of inputs. And in fact, anything can go on inside of here in an evolutionary sense. In Carl's directed graph genomes, the neurons, quote unquote, can actually end up being entire libraries of functions and operators. So what I would suggest is if you wanted to make a symbiogenetic form of A-life, at least at the genome level, at a model of your genome, if you just take something like Carl's architecture, and for all I know, he could do this. It wasn't mentioned in his papers. But if a node in the network itself can be an entire network, then presumably symbiogenesis could occur. Then you could have separately evolved organisms or networks which, if the conditions were proper, were right, could in fact merge at some point. And let me speed up here. Okay, so just to reiterate this 4.6 billion year time period, and I wanted to place the digital biota conferences along the same timeline. So we started with the Cambrian explosion last year at Burgess, and here we are looking off into the future, ahead of zero. Possibly we might have Biota 3 at Shark Bay. So I don't know if Margulis's point of view is just microbial chauvinism of some kind, or if it is something that we can really apply. But I would note that when Tom Ray was talking about getting onto that steep part of the curve with multicellular bodies yesterday, Margulis would probably point out that those multicellular organisms during the Cambrian explosion could not possibly have survived without without all these other living microbes, single-celled organisms, which were alive at the same time and were operating on the environment to producing nutrients and gases that the multicelled organisms needed. So whether that's an important or necessary thing for artificial life, we can debate. And I believe with that I shall stop.
This podcast is covered by Creative Commons. If you use this podcast either in audio or text form, please include a link back to biota.org as the source of this podcast. I'm Tom Barbalay, and if you're interested in more artificial life related stuff, please subscribe to the biota.org mailing list. Thank you very much for tuning into this podcast. Look forward to you tuning into the next podcast.